day where Dick had met him. According to the conditions of his parole, he wasn't supposed to associate with anybody he'd met up there. Lansing. I warned Dick, but he wouldn't listen. He found a room for his friend at the Hotel Olathe, in Olathe, and after that Dick was with him every spare minute. Once they went off on a weekend trip. Mr. Nye, certain as I'm sitting here, Perry Smith was the one put him up to writing them checks. Nye shut his notebook and put his pen in his pocket, and both his hands as well, for his hands were shaking from excitement. Now, on this weekend trip, where did they go? Fort Scott, Mr. Hickok said, naming a Kansas town with a military history. The way I understood it, Perry Smith has a sister lives in Fort Scott. She was supposed to be holding a piece of money belonged to him. $1,500 was the sum mentioned. That was the main reason he'd come to Kansas, to collect this money his sister was holding. So Dick drove him down there to get it. It was only an overnight trip. He was back home a little before noon Sunday. Time for Sunday dinner. I see, said Nye. An overnight trip. Which means they left here sometime Saturday. That would be Saturday, November 14th? The old man agreed. And returned Sunday, November 15th? Sunday noon. Nye pondered the mathematics involved and was encouraged by the conclusion he came to, that within a time span of 20 or 24 hours, the suspects could have made a round-trip journey of rather more than 800 miles, and in the process, murder 4 people. Now, Mr. Hickok, Nye said, on Sunday, when your son came home, was he alone? Or was Perry Smith with him? No, he was alone. He said he'd left Perry off at the Hotel Olathe. Nye, whose normal voice is cuttingly nasal and naturally intimidating, was attempting a subdued timbre, a disarming throwaway style. And do you remember? Did anything in his manner strike you as unusual? Different? Who? Your son. When? When he returned from Fort Scott. Mr. Hickok ruminated. Then he said, he seemed the same as ever. Soon as he came in, we sat down to dinner. He was mighty hungry. Started piling his plate before I'd finished the blessing. I remarked on it. Said, Dick, you're shoveling it in as fast as you can work your elbow. Don't you mean to leave nothing for the rest of us? Of course, he's always been a big eater. Pickles. He can eat a whole tub of pickles. And after dinner, what did he do? Fell asleep, said Mr. Hickok, and appeared to be moderately taken aback by his own reply. Fell fast asleep. And I guess you could say that was unusual. We'd gathered round to watch a basketball game on the TV. Me and Dick and our other boy, David. Pretty soon, Dick was snoring like a buzzsaw, and I said to his brother, Lord, I never thought I'd live to see the day Dick would go to sleep at a basketball game. Did, though. Slept straight through it. Only woke up long enough to eat some cold supper, and right after, went off to bed. Mrs. Hickok rethreaded her darning needle. Her husband rocked his rocker and sucked on an unlit pipe. The detective's trained eyes roamed the scrubbed and humble room. In a corner, a gun stood propped against the wall. He had noticed it before. Rising, reaching for it, he said, You do much hunting, Mr. Hickok? That's his gun. Dick's. Him and David go out once in a while. After rabbits, mostly. It was a 12-gauge Savage shotgun. Model 300, a delicately etched scene of pheasants in flight ornamented the handle. How long has Dick had it? The question aroused Mrs. Hickok. That gun cost over $100. Dick bought it on credit, and now the store won't have it back, even though it's not hardly a month old and only been used the one time. The start of November, when him and David went to Grinnell on a pheasant shoot. He used our names to buy it. His daddy let him. So here we are, liable for the payments. And when you think of Walter, sick as he is, and all the things we need, all we do without... She held her breath, as though trying to halt an attack of hiccups. Are you sure you won't have a cup of coffee, Mr. Nye? It's no trouble. The detective leaned the gun against the wall, relinquishing it, although he felt certain it was the weapon that had killed the Clutter family. Thank you. But it's late, and I have to drive to Topeka, he said. And then, consulting his notebook, Now I'll just run through this, see if I have it straight. Perry Smith arrived in Kansas Thursday, the 12th of November. Your son claimed this person came here to collect a sum of money from a sister residing in Fort Scott. That Saturday, the two drove to Fort Scott, where they remained overnight. I assume in the home of the sister? Mr. Hickok said, No, they never could find her. Seems like she'd moved. Nye smiled. Nevertheless, they stayed away overnight. And during the week that followed, that is, from the 15th to the 21st, Dick continued to see his friend Perry Smith, but otherwise, or as far as you know, he maintained a normal routine. Lived at home and reported to work every day. On the 21st, he disappeared, and so did Perry Smith. And since then, you've not heard from him? He hasn't written you? He's afraid to, said Mrs. Hickok. Ashamed and afraid. Ashamed? Of what he's done. Of how he's hurt us again. And afraid because he thinks we won't forgive him. Like we always have. And will. You have children, Mr. Nye? He nodded. Then you know how it is. One thing more. Have you any idea, any at all, where your son might have gone? Open a map, said Mr. Hickok. Point your finger. Maybe that's it. It was late afternoon, and the driver of the car, a middle-aged traveling salesman who shall here be known as Mr. Bell, was tired. He longed to stop for a short nap. However, he was only 100 miles from his destination, Omaha, Nebraska, the headquarters of the large meatpacking company for which he worked. A company rule forbade its salesmen to pick up hitchhikers, but Mr. Bell often disobeyed it, particularly if he was bored and drowsy, so when he saw the two young men standing by the side of the road, he immediately braked his car. They looked to him like okay boys. The taller of the two, a wiry type with dirty blonde, crew-cut hair, had an engaging grin and a polite manner, and his partner, the runty one, holding a harmonica in his right hand and in his left a swollen straw suitcase, seemed nice enough, shy but amiable. In any event, Mr. Bell, entirely unaware of his guest's intentions, which included throttling him with a belt and leaving him, robbed of his car, his money, and his life, concealed in a prairie grave, was glad to have company. Somebody to talk to and keep him awake until he arrived at Omaha. He introduced himself, then asked them their names. The affable young man with whom he was sharing the front seat said his name was Dick. And that's Perry, he said, winking at Perry, who was seated directly behind the driver. I can ride you boys as far as Omaha. Dick said, Thank you, sir. Omaha's where we were headed. Hoped we might find some work. What kind of work were they hunting? The salesman thought perhaps he could help. Dick said, I'm a first-class car painter. Mechanic, too. I'm used to making real money. My buddy and me, we just been down in old Mexico. Our idea was we wanted to live there. But hell, they don't pay any wages. Nothing a white man could live off. Mexico. Mr. Bell explained that he had honeymooned in Cuernavaca. We always wanted to go back, but it's hard to move around when you've got 5 kids. Perry, as he later recalled, thought, 5 kids. Well, too bad. And listening to Dick's conceited chatter, hearing him start to describe his Mexican amorous conquests, he thought how queer it was, egomaniacal. Imagine going all out to impress a man you were going to kill. A man who wouldn't be alive 10 minutes from now. Not if the plan he and Dick had devised went smoothly. And why shouldn't it? The setup was ideal. Exactly what they had been looking for during the 3 days it had taken them to hitchhike from California to Nevada and across Nevada and Wyoming into Nebraska. Until now, however, a suitable victim had eluded them. Mr. Bell was the first prosperous-seeming solitary traveler to offer them a lift. Their other hosts had been either truck drivers or soldiers, and once a pair of Negro prizefighters driving a lavender Cadillac. But Mr. Bell was perfect. Perry felt inside a pocket of the leather windbreaker he was wearing. The pocket bulged with a bottle of Bayer aspirin and with a jagged, fist-size rock wrapped in a yellow cotton cowboy handkerchief. He unfastened his belt, a Navajo belt, silver buckled and studded with turquoise beads. He took it off, flexed it, placed it across his knees. He waited. He watched the Nebraska prairie rolling by and fooled with his harmonica, made up a tune and played it, and waited for Dick to pronounce the agreed-upon signal. "Hey, Perry, pass me a match." Whereupon Dick was supposed to seize the steering wheel, while Perry, wielding his handkerchief-wrapped rock, belabored the salesman's head. Opened it up. Later, along some quiet side road, use would be made of the belt with the sky-blue beads. Meanwhile, Dick and the condemned man were trading dirty jokes. Their laughter irritated Perry. He especially disliked Mr. Bell's outbursts. Hearty barks that sounded very much like the laughter of Tex John Smith, Perry's father. The memory of his father's laughter increased his tension. His head hurt. His knees ached. He chewed 3 aspirin and swallowed them dry. Jesus. He thought he might vomit or faint. He felt certain he would if Dick delayed the party much longer. The light was dimming. The road was straight, with neither house nor human being in view. Nothing but land, winter-stripped, and as somber as sheet-iron. Now was the time. Now. He stared at Dick, as though to communicate this realization, and a few small signs, a twitching eyelid, a mustache of sweat drops, told him that Dick had already reached the same conclusion. And yet when Dick next spoke, it was only to launch another joke. Here's a riddle. The riddle is, what's the similarity between a trip to the bathroom and a trip to the cemetery? He grinned. Give up? Give up. When you gotta go, you gotta go. Mr. Bell barked. Hey, Perry, pass me a match. But just as Perry raised his hand and the rock was on the verge of descent, something extraordinary occurred. What Perry later called a goddamn miracle. The miracle was the sudden appearance of a third hitchhiker, a Negro soldier for whom the charitable salesman stopped. Say, that's pretty cute, he said as his savior ran toward the car. When you gotta go, you gotta go. December 16th, 1959, Las Vegas, Nevada. Age and weather had removed the first letter and the last, an R and an S, thereby coining a somewhat ominous word, oom. The word, faintly present upon a sun-warped sign, seemed appropriate to the place it publicized, which was, as Harold Nye wrote in his official KBI report, run down and shabby, the lowest type of hotel or rooming house. The report continued, until a few years ago, according to information supplied by the Las Vegas police, it was one of the biggest cat houses in the West. Then fire destroyed the main building, and the remaining portion was converted into a cheap rent rooming house. The lobby was unfurnished, except for a cactus plant 6 feet tall and a makeshift reception desk. It was also uninhabited. The detective clapped his hands. Eventually, a voice, female but not very feminine, shouted, "I'm coming." But it was 5 minutes before the woman appeared. She wore a soiled housecoat and high-heeled gold leather sandals. Curlers pinioned her thinning yellowish hair. Her face was broad, muscular, rouged, powdered. She was carrying a can of Miller High Life beer. She smelled of beer and tobacco and recently applied nail varnish. She was 74 years old, but in Nye's opinion, looked younger. Maybe 10 minutes younger. She stared at him, his trim brown suit, his brown snap-brim hat. When he displayed his badge, she was amused. Her lips parted and Nye glimpsed 2 rows of fake teeth. "Uh-huh. That's what I figured," she said. "Okay. Let's hear it." He handed her a photograph of Richard Hickok. "Know him?" A negative grunt. "Or him?" She said, "Uh-huh. He stayed here a couple of times. But he's not here now. Checked out over a month ago. You want to see the register?" Nye leaned against the desk and watched the landlady's long and lacquered fingernails search a page of pencil-scribbled names. Las Vegas was the first of 3 places that his employers wished him to visit. Each had been chosen because of its connection with the history of Perry Smith. The 2 others were Reno, where it was thought that Smith's father lived, and San Francisco, the home of Smith's sister, who shall here be known as Mrs. Frederick Johnson. Though Nye planned to interview these relatives, and anyone else who might have knowledge of the suspect's whereabouts, his main objective was to obtain the aid of the local law agencies. On arriving in Las Vegas, for example, he had discussed the Clutter case with Lieutenant B.J. Handlin, chief of the detective division of the Las Vegas Police Department. The lieutenant had then written a memorandum ordering all police personnel to be on the alert for Hickok and Smith. Wanted in Kansas for parole violation and said to be driving a 1949 Chevrolet bearing Kansas license J-O-58269. These men are probably armed and should be considered dangerous. Also, Handlin had assigned a detective to help Nye case the pawnbrokers. As he said, there was always a pack of them in any gambling town. Together, Nye and the Las Vegas detective had checked every pawn ticket issued during the past month. Specifically, Nye hoped to find a Zenith portable radio believed to have been stolen from the Clutter House on the night of the crime, but he had no luck with that. One broker, though, remembered Smith. "He's been in and out of here going on a good 10 years, and was able to produce a ticket for a bearskin rug pawned during the first week in November. It was from this ticket that Nye had obtained the address of the rooming house. "Registered October 30th, the landlady said. "Pulled out November 11th. Nye glanced at Smith's signature. The ornateness of it, the mannered swoops and swirls, surprised him. A reaction that the landlady apparently divined, for she said, "Uh-huh. And you ought to hear him talk. Big, long words coming at you in this kind of lispy, whispery voice. Quite a personality. What you got against him? A nice little punk like that." "Parole violation." "Uh-huh. Came all the way from Kansas on a parole case. Well, I'm just a dizzy blonde. I believe you. But I wouldn't tell that tale to any brunettes. She raised the beer can, emptied it, then thoughtfully rolled the empty can between her veined and freckled hands. Whatever it is, it ain't nothing big, big. Couldn't be. I never saw the man yet I couldn't gauge his shoe size. This one, he's only a punk. Little punk tried to sweet-talk me out of paying rent the last week he was here. She chuckled, presumably at the absurdity of such an ambition. The detective asked how much Smith's room had cost. Regular rate, $9 a week, plus a 50-cent key deposit. Strictly cash, strictly in advance. While he was here, what did he do with himself? Does he have any friends? Nye asked. You think I keep an eye on every crawly that comes in here? The landlady retorted. Bums. Punks. I'm not interested. I got a daughter married big, big. Then she said, no, he doesn't have any friends. Least I never noticed him run around with anybody special. This last time he was here, he spent most every day tinkering with his car. Had it parked out front there. An old Ford. Looked like it was made before he was born. He gave it a paint job. Painted the top part black and the rest silver. Then he wrote "For Sale" on the windshield. One day I heard a sucker stop and offer him $40. That's 40 more than it was worth. But he allowed he couldn't take less than 90. Said he needed the money for a bus ticket. Just before he left, I heard some colored man bought it. He said he needed the money for a bus ticket. But you don't know where it was he wanted to go? She pursed her lips, hung a cigarette between them, but her eyes stayed on Nye. Play fair. Any money on the table? A reward? She waited for an answer. When none arrived, she seemed to weigh the probabilities and decide in favor of proceeding. Because I got the impression wherever he was going, he didn't mean to stay long. That he meant to cut back here. Sort of been expecting him to turn up any day. She nodded toward the interior of the establishment. Come along, and I'll show you why. Stairs. Gray halls. Nye sniffed the odors, separating one from another. Lavatory disinfectant, alcohol, dead cigars. Beyond one door, a drunken tenant wailed and sang in the firm grip of either gladness or grief. Boil down, Dutch. Turn it off or out you go, the woman yelled. Here, she said to Nye, leading him into a darkened storage room. She switched on a light. Over there. That box. He asked would I keep it till he came back. It was a cardboard box, unwrapped but tied with cord. A declaration, a warning somewhat in the spirit of an Egyptian curse, was crayoned across the top. Beware. Property of Perry E. Smith. Beware. Nye undid the cord. The knot, he was unhappy to see, was not the same as the half-hitch that the killers had used when binding the Clutter family. He parted the flaps. A cockroach emerged, and the landlady stepped on it, squashing it under the heel of her gold leather sandal. Hey, she said as he carefully extracted and slowly examined Smith's possessions. The sneak. That's my towel. In addition to the towel, the meticulous Nye listed in his notebook, one dirty pillow, souvenir of Honolulu, one pink baby blanket, one pair khaki trousers, one aluminum pan with pancake turner. Other oddments included a scrapbook thick with photographs clipped from physical culture magazines, sweaty studies of weightlifting weightlifters, and inside a shoebox, a collection of medicines, rinses and powders employed to combat trench mouth, and also a mystifying amount of aspirin, At least a dozen containers, several of them empty. Junk, the landlady said. Nothing but trash. True, it was valueless stuff even to a clue-hungry detective. Still, Nye was glad to have seen it. Each item, the palliatives for sore gums, the greasy Honolulu pillow, gave him a clearer impression of the owner and his lonely, mean life. The next day in Reno, preparing his official notes, Nye wrote, "At 9 a.m., the reporting agent contacted Mr. Bill Driscoll, Chief Criminal Investigator, Sheriff's Office, Washoe County, Reno, Nevada. After being briefed on the circumstances of this case, Mr. Driscoll was supplied with photographs, fingerprints, and warrants for Hickok and Smith. Stops were placed in the files on both these individuals as well as the automobile. At 10:30 a.m., the reporting agent contacted Sergeant Abe Faroa, Detective Division, Police Department, Reno, Nevada. Sergeant Faroa and the reporting agent checked the police files. Neither the name of Smith or Hickok was reflected in the felon registration file. A check of the pawn shop ticket files failed to reflect any information about the missing radio. A permanent stop was placed in these files in the event the radio is pawned in Reno. The detective handling the pawn shop detail took photographs of Smith and Hickok to each of the pawn shops in town and also made a personal check of each shop for the radio. These pawn shops made an identification of Smith as being familiar, but were unable to furnish any further information. Thus, the morning. That afternoon, Nye set forth in search of Tex John Smith. But at his first stop, the post office, a clerk at the general delivery window told him he need look no farther. Not in Nevada. For the individual had left there the previous August and now lived in the vicinity of Circle City, Alaska. That, anyway, was where his mail was being forwarded. Gosh! Now there's a tall order, said the clerk in response to Nye's request for a description of the elder Smith. The guy's out of a book. He calls himself the Lone Wolf. A lot of his mail comes addressed that way. The Lone Wolf. He doesn't receive many letters, no, but bales of catalogs and advertising pamphlets. You'd be surprised the number of people send away for that stuff. Just to get some mail, must be. How old? I'd say 60. Dresses Western. Cowboy boots and a big 10-gallon hat. He told me he used to be with a rodeo. I've talked to him quite a bit. He's been in here almost every day the last few years. Once in a while he'd disappear, stay away a month or so. Always claimed he'd been off prospecting. One day last August, a young man came here to the window. He said he was looking for his father, Tex John Smith, and did I know where he could find him? He didn't look much like his dad. The Wolf is so thin-lipped and Irish, and this boy looked almost pure Indian. Hair black as boot polish, with eyes to match. But next morning in walks the Wolf and confirms it. He told me his son had just got out of the army and that they were going to Alaska. He's an old Alaska hand. I think he once owned a hotel there, or some kind of hunting lodge. He said he expected to be gone about 2 years. Nope. Never seen him since. Him or his boy. The Johnson family were recent arrivals in their San Francisco community. A middle-class, middle-income real estate development high in the hills north of the city. On the afternoon of December 18th, 1959, young Mrs. Johnson was expecting guests. Three women of the neighborhood were coming by for coffee and cake and perhaps a game of cards. The hostess was tense. It would be the first time she had entertained in her new home. Now, while she was listening for the doorbell, she made a final tour, pausing to dispose of a speck of lint or alter an arrangement of Christmas poinsettias. The house, like the others on the slanting hillside street, was a conventional suburban ranch house, pleasant and commonplace. Mrs. Johnson loved it. She was in love with the redwood paneling, the wall-to-wall carpeting, the picture windows fore and aft, the view that the rear window provided. Hills, a valley, then sky and ocean. And she was proud of the small back garden. Her husband, by profession an insurance salesman, by inclination a carpenter, had built around it a white picket fence, and inside it a house for the family dog, and a sandbox and swings for the children. At the moment, all four, dog, two little boys, and a girl, were playing there under a mild sky. She hoped they would be happy in the garden until the guests had gone. When the doorbell sounded and Mrs. Johnson went to the door, she was wearing what she considered her most becoming dress, a yellow knit that hugged her figure and heightened the pale tea shine of her Cherokee coloring and the blackness of her feather-bobbed hair. She opened the door, prepared to admit three neighbors. Instead, she discovered two strangers. Men who tipped their hats and flipped open badge-studded billfolds. "Mrs. Johnson," one of them said, "my name is Nye. This is Inspector Guthrie. We're attached to the San Francisco police, and we've just received an inquiry from Kansas concerning your brother, Perry Edward Smith. It seems he hasn't been reporting to his parole officer, and we wondered if you could tell us anything of his present whereabouts." Mrs. Johnson was not distressed, and definitely not surprised, to learn that the police were once more interested in her brother's activities. What did upset her was the prospect of having guests arrive to find her being questioned by detectives. She said, "No, nothing. I haven't seen Perry in 4 years." "This is a serious matter, Mrs. Johnson," Nye said. "We'd like to talk it over." Having surrendered, having asked them in and offered them coffee, which was accepted, Mrs. Johnson said, "I haven't seen Perry in 4 years. Or heard from him since he was paroled. Last summer, when he came out of prison, he visited my father in Reno. In a letter, my father told me he was returning to Alaska and taking Perry with him. Then he wrote again, I think in September, and he was very angry. He and Perry had quarreled and separated before they reached the border. Perry turned back. My father went on to Alaska alone."
"And he hasn't written you since?"
"No."
"Then it's possible your brother may have joined him recently, within the last month."
"I don't know. I don't care."
"On bad terms?"
"With Perry? Yes. I'm afraid of him."
"But while he was in Lansing, you wrote him frequently."
"Or so the Kansas authorities tell us," Nye said. The second man, Inspector Guthrie, seemed content to occupy the sidelines.
"I wanted to help him. I hoped I might change a few of his ideas. Now I know better. The rights of other people mean nothing to Perry. He has no respect for anyone."
"About friends, do you know of any with whom he might be staying?"
"Joe James," she said,
and explained that James was a young Indian logger and fisherman who lived in the forest near Bellingham, Washington. No, she was not personally acquainted with him, but she understood that he and his family were generous people who had often been kind to Perry in the past. The only friend of Perry's she had ever met was a young lady who had appeared on the Johnsons' doorstep in June 1955, bringing with her a letter from Perry in which he introduced her as his wife.
"He said he was in trouble, and asked if I would take care of his wife until he could send for her." The girl looked 20. It turned out she was 14. And of course she wasn't anyone's wife. But at the time I was taken in. I felt sorry for her and asked her to stay with us. She did, though not for long. Less than a week. And when she left, she took our suitcases and everything they could hold. Most of my clothes and most of my husband's. The silver, even the kitchen clock."
"When this happened, where were you living?"
"Denver."
"Have you ever lived in Fort Scott, Kansas?"
"Never. I've never been to Kansas."
"Have you a sister who lives in Fort Scott?"
My sister is dead. My only sister.
Nye smiled. He said, You understand, Mrs. Johnson, we're working on the assumption that your brother will contact you. Write or call. Or come to see you.
I hope not. As a matter of fact, he doesn't know we've moved. He thinks I'm still in Denver. Please, if you do find him, don't give him my address. I'm afraid.
When you say that, is it because you think he might harm you? Hurt you physically?
She considered, and unable to decide, said she didn't know. But I'm afraid of him. I always have been. He can seem so warm-hearted and sympathetic. Gentle. He cries so easily. Sometimes music sets him off, and when he was a little boy, he used to cry because he thought a sunset was beautiful. Or the moon. Oh, he can fool you. He can make you feel so sorry for him.
The doorbell rang. Mrs. Johnson's reluctance to answer conveyed her dilemma, and Nye, who later wrote of her, throughout the interview she remained composed and most gracious, a person of exceptional character, reached for his brown snap brim. Sorry to have troubled you, Mrs. Johnson, but if you hear from Perry, we hope you'll have the good sense to call us. Ask for Inspector Guthrie. After the departure of the detectives, the composure that had impressed Nye faltered. A familiar despair impended. She fought it, delayed its full impact until the party was done and the guests had gone, until she'd fed the children and bathed them and heard their prayers. Then the mood, like the evening ocean fog now clouding the street lamps, closed round her. She had said she was afraid of Perry, and she was. But was it simply Perry she feared, or was it a configuration of which he was part? The terrible destinies that seemed promised the four children of Florence Buckskin and Tex John Smith. The eldest, the brother she loved, had shot himself. Fern had fallen out of a window or jumped, and Perry was committed to violence, a criminal. So, in a sense, she was the only survivor. And what tormented her was the thought that in time she, too, would be overwhelmed. Go mad, or contract an incurable illness, or in a fire lose all she valued. Home, husband, children. Her husband was away on a business trip, and when she was alone, she never thought of having a drink. But tonight, she fixed a strong one, then lay down on the living room couch, a picture album propped against her knees. A photograph of her father dominated the first page. A studio portrait taken in 1922, the year of his marriage to the young Indian rodeo rider, Miss Florence Buckskin. It was a photograph that invariably transfixed Mrs. Johnson. Because of it, she could understand why, when essentially they were so mismatched, her mother had married her father. The young man in the picture exuded virile allure. Everything. The cocky tilt of his ginger-haired head, the squint in his left eye, as though he were sighting a target, the tiny cowboy scarf knotted round his throat, was abundantly attractive. On the whole, Mrs. Johnson's attitude toward her father was ambivalent, but one aspect of him she had always respected, his fortitude. She well knew how eccentric he seemed to others. He seemed so to her, for that matter. All the same, he was a real man. He did things, did them easily. He could make a tree fall precisely where he wished. He could skin a bear, repair a watch, build a house, bake a cake, darn a sock, or catch a trout with a bent pin and a piece of string. Once he had survived a winter alone in the Alaskan wilderness. Alone. In Mrs. Johnson's opinion, that was how such men should live. Wives, children, a timid life are not for them. She turned over some pages of childhood snapshots. Pictures made in Utah and Nevada and Idaho and Oregon.
The rodeo careers of Tex and Flo were finished, and the family, living in an old truck, roamed the country hunting work. A hard thing to find in 1933. Tex John Smith Family Picking Berries in Oregon, 1933, was the caption under a snapshot of four barefooted children wearing overalls and cranky, uniformly fatigued expressions. Berries or stale bread soaked in sweet condensed milk was often all they had to eat. Barbara Johnson remembered that once the family had lived for days on rotten bananas and that, as a result, Perry had got colic. He had screamed all night while Bobo, as Barbara was called, wept for fear he was dying. Bobo was 3 years older than Perry, and she adored him. He was her only toy, a doll she scrubbed and combed and kissed and sometimes spanked. Here was a picture of the two together bathing naked in a diamond-watered Colorado creek. The brother, a pot-bellied, sun-blackened Cupid, clutching his sister's hand and giggling as though the tumbling stream contained ghostly tickling fingers. In another snapshot, Mrs. Johnson was unsure, but she thought probably it was taken at a remote Nevada ranch where the family was staying when a final battle between the parents, a terrifying contest in which horse whips and scalding water and kerosene lamps were used as weapons, had brought the marriage to a stop. She and Perry are astride a pony. Their heads are together. Their cheeks touch. Beyond them, dry mountains burn. Later, when the children and their mother had gone to live in San Francisco, Bobo's love for the little boy weakened until it went quite away. He wasn't her baby anymore, but a wild thing, a thief, a robber. His first recorded arrest was on October 27, 1936, his eighth birthday. Ultimately, after several confinements in institutions and children's detention centers, he was returned to the custody of his father, and it was many years before Bobo saw him again, except in photographs that Tex John occasionally sent his other children. Pictures that, pasted above white ink captions, were part of the album's contents. There was Perry, Dad, and their husky dog. Perry and Dad panning for gold. Perry bear hunting in Alaska. In this last, he was a fur-capped boy of 15 standing on snowshoes among snow-weighted trees, a rifle hooked under his arm. The face was drawn and the eyes were sad and very tired. And Mrs. Johnson, looking at the picture, was reminded of a scene that Perry had made once when he had visited her in Denver. Indeed, it was the last time she had ever seen him, the spring of 1955. They were discussing his childhood with Tex John, and suddenly Perry, who had too much drink inside him, pushed her against a wall and held her there. "I was his nigger," Perry said. "That's all. Somebody he could work their guts out and never have to pay them one hot dime. No, Bobo, I'm talking. Shut up or I'll throw you in the river. Like once when I was walking across a bridge in Japan and a guy was standing there. I never saw him before. I just picked him up and threw him in the river. Please, Bobo. Please listen. You think I like myself? Oh, the man I could have been. But that bastard never gave me a chance. He wouldn't let me go to school. Okay. Okay. I was a bad kid. But the time came I begged to go to school. I happen to have a brilliant mind. In case you don't know, a brilliant mind and talent plus. But no education, because he didn't want me to learn anything, only how to tote and carry for him. Dumb. Ignorant. That's the way he wanted me to be, so that I could never escape him. But you, Bobo, you went to school. You and Jimmy and Fern. Every damn one of you got an education. Everybody but me. And I hate you. All of you. Dad and everybody. as though for his brother and sister's life had been a bed of roses. Maybe so, if that meant cleaning up Mama's drunken vomit, if it meant never anything nice to wear or enough to eat. Still, it was true. All three had finished high school. Jimmy, in fact, had graduated at the top of his class, an honor he owed entirely to his own willpower. That, Barbara Johnson felt, was what made his suicide so ominous. Strong character, high courage, hard work. It seemed that none of these were determining factors in the fates of Tex John's children. They shared a doom against which virtue was no defense. Not that Perry was virtuous, or Fern. When Fern was 14, she changed her name, and for the rest of her short life she tried to justify the replacement. Joy. She was an easygoing girl, everybody's sweetheart. Rather too much everybody's, for she was partial to men, though somehow she hadn't much luck with them. Somehow the kind of man she liked always let her down. Her mother had died in an alcoholic coma, and she was afraid of drink. Yet, she drank. Before she was 20, Fern Joy was beginning the day with a bottle of beer. Then, one summer night, she fell from the window of a hotel room. Falling, she struck a theater marquee, bounced off it, and rolled under the wheels of a taxi. Above, in the vacated room, police found her shoes, a moneyless purse, an empty whiskey bottle. One could understand Fern and forgive her, but Jimmy was a different matter. Mrs. Johnson was looking at a picture of him in which he was dressed as a sailor. During the war, he had served in the Navy. Slender, a pale young seafarer with an elongated face of slightly dour saintliness, he stood with an arm around the waist of the girl he had married, and in Mrs. Johnson's estimation, ought not to have, for they had nothing in common. The serious Jimmy and this teenage San Diego fleet follower, whose glass beads reflected a now long-faded sun. And yet what Jimmy had felt for her was beyond normal love. It was passion. A passion that was in part pathological. As for the girl, she must have loved him, and loved him completely, or she would not have done as she did. If only Jimmy had believed that, or been capable of believing it. But jealousy imprisoned him. He was mortified by thoughts of the men she had slept with before their marriage. He was convinced, moreover, that she remained promiscuous, that every time he went to sea, or even left her alone for the day, she betrayed him with a multitude of lovers, whose existence he unendingly demanded that she admit. Then she aimed a shotgun at a point between her eyes and pressed the trigger with her toe. When Jimmy found her, he didn't call the police. He picked her up and put her on the bed and lay down beside her. Sometime around dawn of the next day, he reloaded the gun and killed himself. Opposite the picture of Jimmy and his wife was a photograph of Perry in uniform. It had been clipped from a newspaper and was accompanied by a paragraph of text. Headquarters, United States Army, Alaska. Private Perry E. Smith, 23, 1st Army Korean combat veteran to return to the Anchorage, Alaska area, is greeted by Captain Mason, public information officer, upon arrival at Elmendorf Air Force Base. Smith served 15 months with the 24th Division as a combat engineer. His trip from Seattle to Anchorage was a gift from Pacific Northern Airlines. Miss Lynn Marquis, airline hostess, smiles approval at welcome. Official U.S. Army photo. Captain Mason, with hand extended, is looking at Private Smith, but Private Smith is looking at the camera. In his expression, Mrs. Johnson saw, or imagined she saw, not gratitude, but arrogance, and, in place of pride, immense conceit. It wasn't incredible that he had met a man on a bridge and thrown him off it. Of course he had.
She had never doubted it.
She shut the album and switched on the television, but it did not console her. Suppose he did come. The detectives had found her. Why shouldn't Perry? He need not expect her to help him. She wouldn't even let him in. The front door was locked, but not the door to the garden. The garden was white with sea fog. It might have been an assembly of spirits. Mama and Jimmy and Fern. When Mrs. Johnson bolted the door, she had in mind the dead as well as the living.
A cloudburst. Rain. Buckets of it. Dick ran. Perry ran too, but he could not run as fast. His legs were shorter, and he was lugging the suitcase. Dick reached shelter, a barn near the highway, long before him. On leaving Omaha, after a night spent in a Salvation Army dormitory, a truck driver had given them a ride across the Nebraska border into Iowa. The past several hours, however, had found them afoot. The rain came when they were 16 miles north of an Iowa settlement called Tenville Junction. The barn was dark.
"Dick?" Perry said.
"Over here," Dick said. He was sprawled on a bed of hay. Perry, drenched and shaking, dropped beside him.
"I'm so cold," he said, burrowing in the hay. "I'm so cold I wouldn't give a damn if this caught fire and burned me alive."
He was hungry, too. Starved. Last night they had dined on bowls of Salvation Army soup, and today the only nourishment they'd had was some chocolate bars and chewing gum that Dick had stolen from a drugstore candy counter.
"Any more Hershey?" Perry asked.
No, but there was still a pack of chewing gum. They divided it, then settled down to chewing it, each chomping on 2½ sticks of Double Mint, Dick's favorite flavor. Perry preferred Juicy Fruit. Money was the problem. Their utter lack of it had led Dick to decide that their next move should be what Perry considered a crazy man stunt, a return to Kansas City. When Dick had first urged the return, Perry said, "You ought to see a doctor." Now, huddled together in the cold darkness, listening to the dark, cold rain, they resumed the argument. Perry once more listing the dangers of such a move, for surely by this time Dick was wanted for parole violation, if nothing more. But Dick was not to be dissuaded. Kansas City, he again insisted, was the one place he was certain he could successfully hang a lot of hot paper. "Hell, I know we've got to be careful. I know they've got a warrant out because of the paper we hung before. But we'll move fast. One day. That'll do it. If we grab enough, maybe we ought to try Florida. Spend Christmas in Miami. Stay the winter if it looks good." But Perry chewed his gum and shivered and sulked. Dick said, "What is it, honey? That other deal? Why the hell can't you forget it? They never made any connection. They never will." Perry said, "You could be wrong. And if you are, it means the corner." Neither one had ever before referred to the ultimate penalty in the state of Kansas. The gallows, or death in the corner, as the inmates of Kansas State Penitentiary have named the shed that houses the equipment required to hang a man. Dick said, "The comedian. You kill me." He struck a match, intending to smoke a cigarette, but something seen by the light of the flaring match brought him to his feet and carried him across the barn to a cow stall. A car was parked inside the stall, a black-and-white two-door 1956 Chevrolet. The key was in the ignition. Dewey was determined to conceal from the civilian population any knowledge of a major break in the clutter case. So determined that he decided to take into his confidence Garden City's two professional town criers, Bill Brown, editor of the Garden City Telegram, and Robert Wells, manager of the local radio station, KIUL.
In outlining the situation, Dewey emphasized his reasons for considering secrecy of the first importance. Remember, there's a possibility these men are innocent. It was a possibility too valid to dismiss. The informer, Floyd Wells, might easily have invented his story. Such tale-telling was not infrequently undertaken by prisoners who hoped to win favor or attract official notice. But even if the man's every word was gospel, Dewey and his colleagues had not yet unearthed one bit of solid supporting evidence. Courtroom evidence. What had they discovered that could not be interpreted as plausible, though exceptional, coincidence? Just because Smith had traveled to Kansas to visit his friend Hickok, and just because Hickok possessed a gun of the caliber used to commit the crime, and just because the suspects had arranged a false alibi to account for their whereabouts the night of November 14th, they were not necessarily mass murderers.
But we're pretty sure this is it. We all think so. If we didn't, we wouldn't have set up a 17-state alarm from Arkansas to Oregon. But keep in mind, it could be years before we catch them. They may have separated or left the country. There's a chance they've gone to Alaska. Not hard to get lost in Alaska. The longer they're free, the less of a case we'll have. Frankly, as matters stand, we don't have much of a case anyhow. We could nab those sons of bitches tomorrow and never be able to prove spit. Dewey did not exaggerate. Except for two sets of boot prints, one bearing a diamond pattern and the other a cat's paw design, the slayers had left not a single clue. Since they seemed to take such care, they had undoubtedly got rid of the boots long ago. And the radio, too. Assuming that it was they who had stolen it, which was something Dewey still hesitated to do, for it appeared to him ludicrously inconsistent with the magnitude of the crime and the manifest cunning of the criminals, and inconceivable that these men had entered a house expecting to find a money-filled safe, and then, not finding it, had thought it expedient to slaughter the family for perhaps a few dollars and a small portable radio. Without a confession, we'll never get a conviction, he said. That's my opinion. And that's why we can't be too cautious. They think they've got away with it. Well, we don't want them to know any different. The safer they feel, the sooner we'll grab them. But secrets are an unusual commodity in a town the size of Garden City. Anyone visiting the sheriff's office, three under-furnished, overcrowded rooms on the third floor of the county courthouse, could detect an odd, almost sinister atmosphere. The hurry-scurry, the angry hum of recent weeks had departed. A quivering stillness now permeated the premises. Mrs. Richardson, the office secretary and a very down-to-earth person, had acquired overnight a dainty lot of whispery, tiptoe mannerisms, and the men she served, the sheriff and his staff, Dewey and the imported team of KBI agents, crept about conversing in hushed tones. It was as though, like huntsmen hiding in a forest, they were afraid that any abrupt sound or movement would warn away approaching beasts. People talked. The trail room of the Warren Hotel, a coffee shop that Garden City businessmen treat as though it were a private club, was a murmuring cave of speculation and rumor. An eminent citizen, so one heard, was on the point of arrest. Or it was now known that the crime was the work of killers hired by enemies of the Kansas Wheat Growers Association, a progressive organization in which Mr. Clutter had played a large role. Of the many stories circulating, the most nearly accurate was contributed by a prominent car dealer, who refused to disclose its source. Seems there was a man who worked for Herb way back yonder around 47 or 48. Ordinary ranch hand. Seems he went to prison, state prison, and while he was there he got to thinking what a rich man Herb was. So about a month ago, when they let him loose, the first thing he did was come on out here to rob and kill those people. But 7 miles westward, in the village of Holcomb,
Not a hint was heard of impending sensations, one reason being that for some while the clutter tragedy had been a banned topic at both of the community's principal gossip dispensaries, the post office and Hartman's Cafe.